Song of Solomon chapter 8, and we're going to cover verse 5 down to verse number 14, finish the book this morning. And I hope that as we come to an end, I hope that you have a better understanding of what this unique book is all about. And maybe you say, boy, I tell you, after these last 7 or 8 weeks, I really know what Song of Solomon is about. Or maybe you say, after these 7 or 8 weeks, I think the preacher has no idea what Song of Solomon is all about. It's one or the other. One or the other. I'll take either one of them. I love going through books of the Bible. I love seeing what comes next. I love watching a truth or a story unfold and how it all ties together. The next book that I will preach through, I'm sure, will be the book of Ecclesiastes. I thought that I would start it on Wednesday nights in August. It'll probably be September before I start that. But I've come to think that there's as much wisdom in Ecclesiastes as there is in the book of Proverbs, just looking at it from a different view, a different perspective. But there's just something thrilling to me about opening up the Scripture and asking the Spirit to reveal it to me and make it meaningful to me. And I hope that that has been your experience somewhat as we have explored the Song of Solomon. I believe that we could go back to the beginning of the book and go back through it and look just for pictures of Christ and the church. There are a lot of parallels, certainly, that we can draw from. But the path that we took was to view the book as a love story between Solomon and the Shulamite. I believe that is the primary application. It is a book of courtship, love, romance, marriage, even struggles, but maturing, developing, deepening love, and I think, as we'll see in these final verses, persevering in love. I'll do a couples retreat in a couple of months up in Buffalo, New York, and I don't know, I would love to go through the Song of Solomon again in those 4 or 5 sessions that I do. I'm impressed by how much marital instruction there is for marriages in this book. I have earned, somewhat deservedly, a reputation as a non-counselor. I am not a counselor. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't want to counsel people in their problems. But I think the best counsel comes from a Bible and the Spirit of God. If you have both of those, then you have the counsel of God. I am convinced that there is a Bible way to do things, and the Bible way always works. And when folks come to me with issues in their marriage or whatever issues they might have, I only have one textbook. And there is a biblical way. There is a biblical way for wives to submit to their husbands, for husbands to love their wives, for you to reverence one another. And if you don't care for the Bible way, I don't know how to help. I've read a lot of Jay Adams' books, and I taught Christian Counseling and Bible Institute, and I don't know how to do it. I honestly don't. All I can say, to all of your problems, there's a Bible, there's a verse. That's it. And God honors that. And in this book, we have, I think in this last section, we come full circle in this relationship. There is no crisis to deal with. There are no struggles that they're trying to overcome with. In fact, there's no steamy passages to struggle through. Thank God. It is really just a reflection on their marriage. And their love has matured to a depth that I think was not even possible even at the beginning. This is something that takes place after a while in marriage. And every marriage has stages that it goes through, and some of those stages are hard. I didn't look up the statistics, but somewhere the statistic is that 50% of marriages end in a divorce. Probably every person in here has a close relative or a close friend or you yourself that has been touched by a divorce. Even Christian marriages divorce and splinter and end in bitterness and all of that. And there's no perfect marriages in our church, and even Aaron and Trinity won't have a perfect marriage because though she is perfect, he is not. So it is flawed from the beginning. And if you don't learn to love one another and to be kind and be forgiving become friends, then you end up in bitterness and anger and all kinds of negative emotions. And so a marriage has to persevere. And you have to learn to persevere with one another. How do you stay not just married, but how do you stay happily married through all the pains and the problems and the struggles? And sometimes a couple will quit on their marriage even though they stay in the marriage. They just quit working on it. I'll just withdraw emotionally. I'll give you the silent treatment. I'll live my life, you live your own life, and you're on one side of the house, I'm on this side of the house, you're on one side of the bed, I'm on the other side of the bed, and we are together, but we're not together. And so in these closing verses, the theme is persevering in marriage and keeping it going, and what God has put together, just keeping it moving. And I believe there are some things that we can pick out that will be an encouragement or an anchor to help us stay married, happily married together, even when circumstances are against us. And so I take these verses and I want to highlight five words that I will outline it with. And the first one is found in verse number 5. And here's the word that I would put to verse number 5. And you have to give me a little bit of time to explain this. I would give it the word providence. Providence. Look at verse number 5. Who is this that cometh up from the wilderness leaning upon her beloved? I raised thee up under the apple tree. There thy mother brought thee forth. There she brought thee forth that bare thee. Now it's one of the more difficult verses in the book. For one reason, we're not 100% sure who's speaking in the verse. It may be the chorus of these daughters of Jerusalem speaking, but we don't even know if the daughters of Jerusalem was a actual group or was a literary device that Solomon employed to carry the story along. But it's a country scene. They're coming up out of the wilderness, and we believe that they have taken a trip back to her home place. If it is not the daughters of Jerusalem speaking, then it is most likely Solomon that is speaking. Who is this that cometh up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? She is leaning on him, depicting a closeness. I don't think there is anything sexual about this. And it seems that they've come back to her home where she was born. And then this strange statement, I raised thee up under the apple tree. We have no idea. I raised thee up. That's a very difficult phrase unless it's his way of saying, I found you there. It's very, very difficult. But without having to parse every statement and know exactly what every statement is saying, here is the essence of verse number 5, is that in their relationship they've come full circle and they've come back to the very beginning. This may be where he first met her. This is where their courtship perhaps began. And he doesn't talk so much about the beginning of the courtship, but he talks about the beginning of her life. All the way back to her birth before he ever came into the picture. So here's what I take from verse number 5, and I read between the lines a little bit. I hope not too much, but there is a hint of destiny here. There is a hint of providence here. We were made for each other. You were made for me. It is the idea that God has put us together. This is where it began, and even before it was meant to be, even before I came into the picture, he's going all the way back to her birth. And here's what I want to draw from this. It's a difficult verse for me, but here's the principle that I want to draw, that when difficulties come up in a marriage, it is the sense of providence that God put this thing together that will help us to keep working on this marriage. So many people want to just throw in the towel, just throw up our hands and just quit. But when you realize that God was involved in this whole thing, that is a holding union before God that becomes an anchor to persevere. It is very possible that you married out of God's will. Very possible that you made a mistake. But if you did marry out of God's will, it is now God's will for you to be married. It's not a mistake now. And if you married right, you should be able to look back to the beginning of this thing and see the hand of God in this. God brought me to you and God brought you to me, and that providence becomes an anchor for the rest of our life together. And Proverbs 16 and verse 9 says that a man's heart devises his way but the Lord directeth his steps. God doesn't make any mistakes. I heard a very simple illustration, very, very elementary. When a child first goes to kindergarten, you don't give the child a pen. Give the child a pencil. All of his lessons, all of his letters, all of his numbers, he writes in pencil. There's a reason for that. You expect him to make a mistake. He needs a big eraser. He's going to mess up. He's going to get outside of the lines. And so, because we know that he's going to make mistakes, and because there's going to do a lot of erasing and rewriting, he always writes in principle. Here is the illustration. God never writes our story in pencil. It's always in pen. And the reason why is because God doesn't make any mistakes. But isn't it our tendency that when things are going smooth in our marriage, boy, it's God's will. But when there are struggles in our marriage, I wonder, did I make a mistake? Maybe we should have never got married in the first place. Maybe I should bail out because it's all wrong. And we want to erase the past and rewrite a different story, but God doesn't make mistakes. He's going back to the beginning, and he sees the hand of God. When I reflect on the circumstances that put Jennifer and I together, I see the hand of God. So my senior year in high school, we lived in Greenville, North Carolina. And that year, my dad went up to West Virginia and preached in a meeting in a little country church in West Virginia. I had never in my life ever had a thought of living in West Virginia. And in my senior year of high school, my dad moved and took a church in West Virginia. It's never good to move your senior year of high school. It's never good. But that's what we did. And we moved up there, and of course, I lived there 7 or 8 years before going off to college and moving away and what have you. But I think that, and I won't go through the whole story, but I think how vastly my life would have been. I wonder, who would I have met? Who would I have married? What would my kids have been like? I wonder what would my life have been like if it had not been for the hand of God and that decision, though we couldn't see it, moving us to West Virginia and then her family coming to the church and putting us together and how vastly my life would have been. And no matter what our marriage goes through, I look back and I see God put us together. Providence is involved in this. It's an anchor to persevering. There's a second word in verse number 6 that I would give you. It is the word promise. She says, set me as a seal upon thine heart, as a seal upon thine arm. A seal was placed on a man's most valued possessions. It indicates ownership. She is saying that I want you to treat me as your most valued possession. I want to be the most important person in your life. In your heart, it speaks of affections. It speaks of emotions. I want to be the object of your thinking. Be totally devoted to me. No other woman. On your arm, it speaks of deeds and actions. I want you to act like it. I want you to show me. And a persevering marriage is built upon unwavering devotion. It is the desire of every woman's heart to be treated as the most valued individual in the world. I had the security of knowing that my husband is not interested in any other woman. He's interested only as me. His love for me is like a seal. It tells me that I am his and he is mine. I know a businessman that I have had some dealings with in the last several months, and I have been with him in some businesses, and he's a lost man. Now, he says that he's a Christian, but he smokes, he drinks, he cusses. What a strange Christian. He's a lost man is what he is. And I have noticed that when I see him out in public and he's with a woman, it doesn't matter who she is, he is always flirting with her. He's just a flirt. We've had a number of flirts in our church. I remember when I first came here, we had a man in our church, and he was here before I came, and he was real touchy-feely with the ladies. You know, he's putting his arm around them, petting them on the back, and what have you. And he was going to get killed. That's what was going to happen. And I saved his life by inviting him to go somewhere else. You've met people like that. She says, set me as a seal upon thine heart. Hey, guys, you don't call other women. You don't text them. You don't take them out to lunch. You don't put your careers above your wife. You don't put your ministry above your wife. You don't put your children before your marriage. You don't keep up with the old flame. You don't look up the boyfriend on Facebook to see what he's doing. Where's he at? No. None of that. She says, for love is strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. And the coals thereof are coals of fire, which have a most vehement flame. Now she compares love to several things, and it's really strange. Love is strong as death. Now, that's strange. But when death comes to take somebody, nothing can stop it. Nobody can resist death because when it calls, it is powerful. And when death takes hold of someone, it never lets go. And she says that love is strong as death. It's so powerful that you can't stop it. It won't let go. And if you will love me like no one else, then nothing will be able to separate us. They've had some conflict in the past, but when love is there, that conflict cannot come between them. We will not allow anything to tear us apart. You can have disagreements and you can have intense issues. You keep coming back to one thing. I love you. And I won't let go. I won't quit on the marriage. I won't hurt you because love. Love will affair proof your marriage. Love is like death. Then she says that love is like jealousy. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. Now jealousy, we look at it as a negative, but sometimes jealousy is a positive. It's a bad thing in that we're not supposed to be envious of one another. We understand that in the book of Numbers there is the law of the jealousy offering, and a man had to be very careful that he's not overly possessive and suspicious of his wife. And jealousy in that regard is a bad thing. We've seen men and women who are paranoid. I think that I know a man who is paranoid in his relationship and the way that he treats his wife. It's very, 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 well, it is what it is. And I think about the woman who was always suspicious of her husband having an affair. And every time that he came home from work, she's checking his clothing and smelling him to see if he smells like perfume and everything. And he goes through this every day, looking for lipstick on his collar. And finally he comes home one day and she's checking his coat for hairs, and a blonde hair, a stray hair, anything. And she can't find any hairs. And he says, finally, doesn't it prove to you that I'm not having an affair? She said, no, it proves you're having an affair with a bald woman. That's what it is. Well, that's jealousy. The kind of jealousy that is destructive to any relationship. But then the Bible talks about God being a jealous God. And he says, don't worship idols. You worship me alone. His desire for Israel and for the church to be devoted just to him. And she wants him to love her with a jealous love. I don't want to compete with anybody else, exclusively devoted to me. Then in verse number 7, many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown it. Two of the most powerful natural forces are floods and fire. You've seen the pictures, the videos of the fires that have swept Northern California, and hundreds of thousands of acres destroyed, and hundreds of homes are destroyed. And love is like that. Love is like a flood that it can't be quenched by water. It's like a flood that it sweeps away everything in its path, and there's no obstacle that gets between you and the person that you love. Some of you may know the name Benjamin Warfield, B.B. Warfield. B.B. Warfield was a Presbyterian pastor back in the 1800s and then the early 1900s. He taught at Princeton University for 34 years, I believe it was. Wrote a lot of books. He's considered a very well-renowned theologian of a past generation. Wrote a book called The Inspiration and Authority of the Scriptures. Benjamin Warfield. In August of 1876, B.B. Warfield married Annie Pierce Kincaid. Annie Kincaid. And they took their honeymoon to Germany. He had preached a lot and held conferences in Germany a lot. They took their honeymoon to Germany. And while it was on their honeymoon, there was a fierce storm that came, and they were out, and Annie was struck by lightning. And it paralyzed her. And Annie was permanently disabled for the rest of her life. She became a functioning invalid during her honeymoon. And she would never recover. And here's this young preacher who has devoted his life to Christ. He's well known. He's a theologian. He's teaching at universities. He's writing books. And on his honeymoon, with the dreams of this wonderful life together, his wife becomes an invalid. And for the next 39 years until she died, he devoted himself to Annie. And what most people don't know about B.B. Warfield is that he rarely left his home for over 2 hours at a time for the next 39 years because he was devoted to her. A much sought-after man in churches and universities, but his first devotion was to his wife. Many waters cannot quench love. Neither can floods drown it. And that promise of unconditional love, is an anchor for marriages to persevere. Verse number 7. If a man would give all the substance of his house for love, it would utterly be contemned. You can't buy love. It is not something that is for sale. If you had to buy it, even if you sold your house and you bought it, that kind of love would be contemptible. It would be disregarded. It wouldn't last. But true love has no price on it. The promise of true love. But then look at verse number 8. The third word that I would give you as an anchor for persevering in marriage is purity. Look at verse number 8. We have a little sister and she hath no breasts. What should we do for our sister in the day when she should be spoken for? If she be a wall, we will build her a palace of silver. If she be a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. Then she speaks, I am a wall. And my breasts like towers, thin was I, and his eyes as one that found favor. Boy, that sounds really odd, doesn't it? Wow. So what's it talking about? The Shulamite is speaking. She's reflecting back on her younger years as a growing young lady. She has matured as a young lady, but she had some older brothers who took care of her. And one of the things that her brothers were concerned about as she began to grow is that she remain pure, that she stay a virgin, and that when it came time for her to marry, that she would be the type of person that an honorable man would want to marry. It's very possible that her father has died because there's never any mention of her father, so the brothers would step into the place of her protectors, and they're going to protect her because one day men are going to come calling, and we want her to be pure. So how are they going to do this? Well, first of all, they're going to find out what kind of girl that she's going to be. Verse 9, if she be a wall, we'll build her upon her a palace of silver. If she be a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. If she acts like a wall, if she makes herself inaccessible to men, then we're going to reward her. If she acts like a door, if she be a door, and she invites all kinds of advances from all kinds of men, then we're going to board her up. We're going to enclose her with boards of cedar. We're going to isolate her. We're going to limit her socially. We're going to keep her at home. That's what we're going to do. I think that's the essence of it. We're going to protect her morality. We're going to develop, we're going to protect her character. We're going to encourage her. If she stays pure, we're going to discipline her if she acts impure. Well, verse number 10, she says, I'm a wall. She's speaking. She said, that's how I grew up. I wasn't a flirt. I wasn't out there. I wasn't accessible to everybody. I didn't have 14 boyfriends and 13 I didn't have any of that. I kept myself pure, and I'm not open to the sexual advances of men. And I've grown up. I've matured as a woman. And the result is that she found favor in the eyes of the right man. I've kept myself pure, and I've met the right man, and he found favor with me. I was the kind of person that a good man would want to marry. Every woman or every man wants to marry a woman that has kept herself for him. That's why I hate the dating scene. Typical dating scene is for a teenager by the time he's 18 to have five or six girlfriends, four breakups. All it is practice divorce. That's all it is. And I don't care for it. Young ladies and young men should keep themselves pure for their future mates, to be the kind of young lady that a spiritual young man would want to be with. A spiritual man does not want to marry a girl who's been like a door to other men. So purity. But the idea of purity doesn't apply just to before marriage, but it applies after marriage. That same hands-off approach to other people, that wall to other people comes into the marriage. When sexual impurity invades a marriage, it wreaks all kinds of havoc. Whether it's pornography or affairs or adultery, how destructive, how damaging. And when your spouse has the assurance that my husband or my wife is mentally and emotionally and physically pure, it becomes an anchor in your marriage. Every once in a while, when we're driving down the road, I always set my phone on the center console, and my wife will pick up my phone and start going through my text messages. She knows the password, and she just goes through. I don't think that she's checking on me. I just think she's real nosy. I think that's what it is. If you ever text me, no. Strong chance she's going to read the text. She knows everything. And when my wife reaches over and gets my phone, and she turns it over and begins to scroll through the text messages, there is no fear. There's no apprehension. There is no, ooh, did I delete that text? There's none of that. Look it over. Read them all. And she makes comments. Well, he's stupid. What did he want? Okay. But what an assurance. What an assurance, really. Pick up my phone. Look at my emails. Look at my texts. See who I've been calling. Look at me on Find a Friend. See where I am at right now. It doesn't matter. I want that openness. I want that vulnerability. And that purity of heart produces purity of actions, and that helps you to persevere in a marriage. Purity. Purity. Well, there's one other word. There's two more. Privilege. Look at verse number 11. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal-Hamon. He laid out the vineyard unto keepers, every one for the fruit thereof was to bring 1,000 pieces of silver. My vineyard, which is mine, is before me. Thou, O Solomon, must have 1,000, and those that keep the fruit thereof, 200. Again, man, a difficult, difficult passage. Shulamite's still speaking. She's saying that Solomon owned vineyards nearby at Baal-Hamon. Nobody really knows where Baal-Hamon was. And he listened out to people, probably her brothers that were workers in the field. And what they had to do, they had to produce enough grapes to earn him 1,000 shekels of silver. And they got to keep 200 shekels of silver. That was the arrangement. But what does it mean? And I think that verse number 11 and 12 are some of the most confusing verses in the book for me. So I have to guess. I can guess or I can skip it. And I'll guess. It sounds like to me like she's comparing herself to one of those vineyards. She has kept it. She has given it herself to Solomon. He can enjoy the fruit of it, 1,000 shekels that he would get out of this marriage, what he desires. Her brothers are responsible. They deserve some credit because they were responsible for preserving her until Solomon found her. So she's not asking Solomon to pay them money, but recognize, appreciate their part in all this. However, just as a vineyard is expected to produce and to bring forth fruit, and do you enjoy it? She says, my vineyard, which is mine, is before me. Thou, O Solomon, must have 1,000, and those that keep the fruit thereof, 200. Here I am as your vineyard. I've kept myself pure for you. I have been prepared for you. And I want you to get everything out of this marriage that you want, out of everything that you have desired out of this marriage. You came expecting 1,000 shekels out of your vineyard, and I am before you as your vineyard. I want you to enjoy my love and not be disappointed in what you find. My brothers will get some enjoyment, the pleasure of knowing that they had a part in this, but it won't be anything like the pleasure, the joy that you will receive, the privilege of enjoying my love that I give to you. Now, if that is not what verse number 11 and 12 say, it says, then write your own commentary. But the idea is, how fulfilled or how disappointed is your spouse and what they receive from that marriage? Is there fulfillment or disappointment there? There's one other word in verse number 13. It is the word passion. Thou that dwellest in the gardens, the companions, hearken to thy voice, cause me to hear it. Make haste, my beloved. And be thou like a roe or to a young hart upon the mountains of spices. Now, I think that Solomon speaks in verse number 13. I believe that she responds in verse number 14. He says, I want to hear your voice. I tell me what you're thinking, what's on your mind. I want to hear your thoughts, your desires. So in verse 14, she says, well, here it is. Make haste, my beloved, and be thou like to a roe or to a young hart upon the mountains of spices. She is saying the same thing she said at the beginning of the book. Do you remember the very first thing she said? Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. It's passion, romance. And she comes back to the exact same thing. If you read through the book, you remember her comparing herself to a garden. You have no problem recognizing this as seductive talk. I want you to romance me. I want us to be involved romantically. That same passion that burned in the beginning of our marriage, I want it to burn in the end of our marriage. Now, I chuckle when I read this because I'm looking at a lot of old people. When you get old, your body's ache and your mind tires and you want to go to bed at 8:30. Last night at 8:15, I was in bed with the lights out. It's over. It's a good time to go to bed. When you get old, you're like that. And so I look at this, and some of you have been married longer than I have been alive, but passion in a marriage should not die with old age. They are still passionately in love. And this book leaves us feeling like that this love, this passion is going to go on and on and on. And you may have to work to keep that passion alive, but you're never too old to hold hands, to take dates together, to do things together, to work to keep that passion alive. You will never forget the storms that you go through together, but don't forget the passions that have held you together through those storms. That passion, that fervent love, it is an anchor that will help you to persevere in marriage. There's a term in music theory. I remembered it, and I couldn't remember exactly what it meant, and so I had to look it up. It's called resolving the chord. Resolving the chord. Resolving a chord is a final movement in a chord. Sometimes you listen to a song, a final chord, and there needs to be one final movement. They call it from dissonance to consonance, from an unstable sound to a more final sound. And sometimes when somebody sings a song, they come to the ending and they're sustaining this note, and it takes one downward turn or one upward turn, and that resolves the chord. And without resolving the chord, it's almost, you're expecting it. When that one last note, that last chord, now you know the song can end. This is a song, Song of Solomon. It is a song, the Song of Solomon. And when I look at this last verse and how that it ends, it doesn't resolve the song. There's no final note. There's no closing few words to say this is the end. She just says, I want to be passionate. I want to be romantic. Come to me like a royal young heart upon the mountains of spices. And it just drops. It just ends. And I think that it's supposed to end that way. Because love is not supposed to resolve and just die. It's supposed to just keep going. It's supposed to just sustain that note. It's not supposed to end because you fell out of love. It's not supposed to end because you found somebody else. It's not supposed to end because you can't stand each other anymore. No, it's supposed to keep going and going and going and not fade out, but just to blossom and to keep growing and keep going. And that sustained note and that final movement, it never resolves to say, all right, the song is finally over. It just sustains. It just keeps going. So here's five words from this section that will help you to persevere in marriage. I hope as we've come through this book, again, as I said at the beginning, I hope you either have a better understanding of what Song of Solomon is about, and I go back, boy, there are some verses I look at that and say, it's a tough verse. And even if we've not interpreted every verse exactly like it's supposed to be, I hope the Lord has encouraged you in your marriages, future marriages. This is the kind of love that I want. This is the kind of marriage that I want. I love the wife that God gave me. I'll be honest with you, this week my wife and I had a day. We had a day that it was not a Song of Solomon day. It just wasn't. You ever had one like that? I never had a thought of divorcing her. Never did. I had a thought of killing her. Not divorcing her. You'll have days like that. But don't have 2 days like that. Amen? Let's stand together. Heavenly Father, such a challenging book, such a difficult book. And we have the honesty to come to it and say, Lord, this is the verse I understand. This is the verse I don't understand. Help us. But Lord, the whole warp and woof of the book, Lord, is that passion, that romance, that perseverance, that deepening, that maturing. It is a picture of what marriage ought to be. And how sad and how shameful it is that even in Christian marriages, even in the church, there are men and women who have promised themselves to each other, but to go back on that promise. Christian marriages that end in divorce. Christian marriages that are full of fightings and struggles and just things that belong really only to the world. But when we have the example of Christ, when we have the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, when we have the instruction of the Bible, there's no excuse not for us to have strong marriages and passionate marriages and exemplary marriages. And so I pray that as we've gone through this book, that you have taught us something, placed in our heart, Lord, a new appreciation for the spouse, the mate, that you thank you for my wife. Lord, thank you for providence that put us together. And we look back on life and things that we cried back then, we now look back at it and we laugh at. Because that flood, that fire, it couldn't quench the love in our marriage. And we thank you for that. Bless the 11 o'clock hour, I pray in Jesus' name.